From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block, with the second in our series of stories about the end of life and the gift of teaching. 2 months ago, we joined a class of first-year medical students on their first day in the Gross Anatomy Lab, the day they started working on the cadavers they'd be dissecting over the next 10 weeks. We wanted to follow their evolution to see how their thinking about the body and about death might change during the course. So about a week ago, we went back to the University of Maryland in Baltimore to be with the students as they neared the end of their class. Again, a note of caution. By its nature, this story will include some graphic description and sound. As the students unwrap the cadavers, it's immediately clear a lot of work has been done over the past weeks. Legs and arms have been dissected down to the bone. Internal organs are gone. There's not much left on the metal tables. When we visited before, the bodies were lying face down. Now they're face up, and seeing those faces is a jolt. One student tells me she's thankful the face of her cadaver looked at peace. Today, many of the students are at work removing the brain. It's one of the last things they'll do in this class. On our first visit, the first time a student turned on a bone saw, everyone stopped to watch and listen, in fascination and maybe horror. Now no one even notices.
Oh, watch your hands.
It's reassuring somehow to realize just how hard it is to get into the skull. It can take an hour of careful sawing and chiseling before the students can pry off the top half globe of the skull to expose the brain.
Oh, that sounded good. More. Now we're getting it. Oh, wow.
Sounds like Velcro.
It does sound like Velcro, and inside lie the two pinkish hemispheres of the brain in twisted folds. Justin Slavin cups his hands around the brain of his cadaver.
It feels, I mean, basically it's sort of like a water balloon. It's just a film containing like semi-gelatinous stuff.
Some of the students climb up and kneel on their table alongside the body to get a close look. They're far less tentative than they were on the first day, more confident in their skills and their knowledge. And the students now have another key bit of information. A few weeks ago, they were told how old their body donors were when they died and how they died. In this lab, lung cancer, Parkinson's disease, stroke, congestive heart failure, among other causes, the body donors are 20 women, 14 men. The ages range from 53 to 102. And as the students probe deeper into the bodies, they get glimpses into their donors' lives. Student Ruth Bringman has been working on a man who died at age 100.
We were really surprised that he was 100 just because we didn't think his body was, it didn't seem that old. Like his muscles and all were really well defined for a 100-year-old, you know. This was not a person that died who was, you know, living in a nursing home bed or something. They were, you know, very active right up until the time of their death.
It must be interesting to get a clue like that into what kind of life they may have had.
You gotta wonder, you know, this guy could have been running or walking, then just, you know, died in his sleep one night, really.
The students have gotten to know these people intimately. Bonnie Cho and Beth Jolly have been working on a man they've named Frank, and there have been surprises.
Especially the pacemaker. Like, we didn't know, like, he had heart problems, but when we actually went into the heart, we were running into wires, and we were like, oh no, you know, what's this? And we just followed it all the way through. I mean, our pacemaker still goes off occasionally.
Still goes off?
Yes, it does.
Uh-huh. It has a little alarm, sort of like a watch alarm, and it just goes off, you know, at random times.
That must have scared you the first time, I would think.
We looked around the room. Where's the sound coming from? But, yeah.
The students have found anatomical defects the people probably never knew they had. And some find they just can't dissect certain parts of the body. For some, it's the face. For others, the hands. So personal, they say. They imagine those hands holding grandchildren. So the lab partners switch off. One takes over when another falters. After class, we sat down with six of the students to talk more about how their thinking has shifted, what's changed for them, and how they think of these bodies and their own. They are Justin Slavin, Preetha Soka, Kyrie Butler, Ali Parnes, Andrea Harriott, and George Kochman, who begins.
We're definitely a lot more comfortable with the body. We've done a lot of different things, and we've had to flip the body and move the body and stick your hands in various cavities and basically in some ways beat the body, you know, and take it apart. So I know I'm very comfortable with it.
I wonder if you're almost surprised to find yourself getting comfortable. Preetha, any thoughts?
I think I kind of ebbed and flowed in how I was comfortable. I was comfortable until, because the face was covered for a while and I wasn't really thinking about it and I was going through the motions and I'd gotten comfortable with the body. And then once I think we uncovered the face earlier last week, and that's when I was a little apprehensive again, because at that point it's much more real to you with what you're doing. And I think this week really hit it home with dissecting the brain, because it's their thought center and you don't really think about that when you're dissecting the rest of the body until you get to that area. So I definitely went up and down in how comfortable I was.
Allie?
It was interesting that some of us had that same visceral reaction again when we got to the brain, because it was though that was the last, you know, remnant of who this person was that we were kind of plucking away, and that it was a little more difficult and more thought-provoking, I think.
Andrea?
I guess I sort of share the same thoughts as Preetha, that when we uncovered the face, it was really personal and sort of emotional for me, because for our body, his eyes were open, and so it was a strange sort of feeling that you're connecting with someone that donated their body to you, that you've been learning off of for however many weeks or months, and now you actually get to look in their eyes. It was really chilling.
George?
One thing that I found is I think that there's a danger of breaking the body, and partially it's the way that we dissect, is you break the body into parts. You know, you have to work on only the lower arm. You think of it as the lower arm and not, you know, the lower arm of a human being who's attached to it. And you tend to see it sometimes as a machine that may have some problems and that may need to be fixed, but there's not always the emotional attachment of, is there something else we need to heal as well?
Allie?
One of the things that we had heard about, and probably you might have suspected, was that this process would actually make us more detached or less empathetic. And I found the exact opposite was true. Our person had metastatic melanoma, and we didn't need anyone to tell us this because it was pretty obvious throughout the process. We would find pigmented tumors everywhere, and we would realize some of the difficulties that he had perhaps swallowing or with other things. And one of the professors was explaining to us that his breathing was probably difficult because there was some fluid in the lungs. And one of the partners of mine in my lab group actually patted his hand at that moment. Had that happened to me the first day, I wouldn't have been able to handle it. I would have walked out of the room. And that's why I think this process is so incredible, because we're comfortable not with his pain, but we allow ourselves to feel and at the same time try to learn.
I'm curious about what happens when you leave this room, you go home to your families and friends, and how much of this shadows you as you go about your lives. Justin?
I think all you really need to do is smell our hands right now to know exactly like how much this follows us. As soon as I get home, like especially on like Fridays is when I see my girlfriend, first thing she makes me do is hit the shower with as much scented stuff as possible, because it's pretty intense.
Kyrie?
As far as it traveling with me after class, it's so exciting, all these structures and everything, and you so want to talk to other people about it, not just everyone here, but at the same time, you don't want to say so much, because we talked about this in class, that you don't want to scare anyone off from maybe donating their body later on, or you know, you don't want to give the school a bad image. But at the same time, as soon as I find someone, I have a friend whose parents own a funeral home, and he started talking to me about anatomy. I was like, great, I can talk to somebody.
There is an obvious violence to everything that you're doing in here. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on that and how physical an act this is that you've been doing. Yeah. Justin?
Basically, I wish there was an easier way to do it, because there's a lot of physical exertion. The first day, it was a lot of just cutting and pulling, and we didn't really know what was going on.
George?
The things we do on a daily basis to the body, where they are violent, and sometimes the stuff we see is disgusting. And there's this violence and there's this disgusting part. But the body itself is beautiful. It's never ugly. And I think we have that sort of appreciation for the body as a beautiful thing and an amazing thing.
I'm curious whether your experience in here has
made you think about your own death, what you would want done with your own bodies? You're all very young, so it's not the first thing on your mind, but have you let yourself go there or no?
Allie? I actually felt like I should now. I should give this to somebody else. And I had a funny thought, which was that I should get a tattoo for all those first-year med students and put something really funny on it, you know.
Don't cut here.
Be kind. Yeah, I don't know. I would think about doing it now. It's a wild thought.
Anybody else?
I mean, looking at it from another perspective, my dad the other day was saying how he didn't feel like his organs were strong enough to be donated, but he was thinking about donating his body for educational purposes. And my first thought was no. And I think a lot of it was because I see what we do every day, and it is very destructive. And I think it's also the thought of my dad was like, well, you know, someone donated that body to you. Why, you know, I should do the same thing for another person. And I think when you take it out from an emotional standpoint, that's 100% right. But when you take it from, you know, that's my dad, I think it's much harder to swallow.
Kyrie?
Honestly, I think I would probably be reluctant to have my body in this. I would definitely want it to be donated to science for a reason, but not necessarily for the anatomy class. It is extraordinarily destructive, and I can't separate that human, you know, aspect of it from the anatomy. Now, how I feel hopefully 60 years from now, probably a lot different, I imagine.
That's Kyrie Butler, along with Preetha Soka, Allie Parnes, George Kochman, Justin Slavin, and Andrea Harriott, first-year medical students at the University of Maryland in Baltimore. They all agree on a few things. They marvel at the complexity of the body. They're grateful for the selfless gift these donors made, and they feel they've owed it to those donors to make the most of their time in this lab. They take their final exams tomorrow. In a month or so, we'll report on who donates their bodies and why. You can hear our previous story and see photographs of the lab at our website, npr.org.